Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, we are starting the show by talking with a couple of guys who are hosts of a podcast. It's a kind of a highfalutin one. It's called Farm Tales and Cow Pies. And I don't think you'd find two better guys to do a podcast like this than our two guests. Daryl Wormadal grew up on a dairy farm in Oakland, Minnesota, and he's also worked at AgriView, an ag newspaper I'm sure many people have been familiar with over the years. Daryl, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's an honor.
Well, his partner in crime is Dan Wiese, who also grew up on a dairy farm. He's in Stoddard in Wisconsin, and also a part-time DJ on Z93.
Well, that was a few years back. Right now, I just host a buy, sell, and trade show on our AM and FM station. So that goes back a ways, those in the 90s.
Those are fun to do. We'll have to spend some time. At one point, you're going to have to come back and talk about those shows, because I always got a kick out of those shows.
I love doing the show on Saturday mornings.
But I bet you love doing this podcast, too. And as I tell you what, as I talk with Daryl and Dan, I want to hear from you. You can talk to them, too. Why are you maybe proud of your family's rural heritage? Do you ever raise chickens or spend thousands of hours milking, like me and like I and Dan and Daryl? I hope you'll join in. Maybe foods that remind you of your childhood. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Daryl, tell us about your podcast, Farm Tales and Cow Pies. What do you talk about in that podcast?
Well, Larry, Dan and I grew up on dairy farms back in the 50s and 60s. And our podcast is kind of relating back to that, some of the great memories that we had of doing that. And then we also look at farming of today. It's a whole different beast out there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's amazing the number of cows that are on farms. We expanded our herd back in the 60s. We went from 30 to about 55, and we thought, wow, we're
big time,
hitting the big time. You know, we put a pipeline in and everything, and so we're milking 55 cows twice a day. A lot of fun. My main job was washing cows. You ever wash a cow, Larry?
Oh,
I'll bet you
several thousand times.
Yeah, you didn't have to wash the whole cow. You just had to get those four attachments and the udder.
Yeah.
But here I am. I worked in AgriView for 34 years, and there's a farm up in northeast Wisconsin, Kinnard Farms. They milk over 8,000 cows.
Yeah.
They have a rotary parlor with 100 cows on it.
Yeah.
It's
so why start a podcast on this? Why'd you do it?
Because I feel that, okay, there's 10,000 baby boomers that are hitting the age of 65 every day. A lot of them grew up on the farm. You know, back in the 60s, there was in Minnesota, nationwide, there was over 20 million farmers.
Oh yeah.
Today, there's less than 2 million. That's less than the city of Chicago. Wisconsin, dairy farmers. We had 65,000 dairy farmers in Wisconsin. Now we're less than 6,500. 90% of the people that grew up on dairy farms back in the baby boomer years, like Dan and I, we left. We pursued other interests. But you mentioned the smell of fresh-cut hay. You talk about that feel of a calf when you're trying to get them to drink that milk replacer for the first time. And it just takes people back. And the other thing is the senior communities, Larry. There's a lot of people are moving into these senior communities, and they're looking for things to do. They're looking for conversation. They're looking, rather than just sitting there, loneliness and isolation is a major problem. And when Dan and I do our presentations at those centers, it's just amazing to see people light up, and then they can't wait to tell you stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's, you know, everybody's, and the barns, Larry, there's so many of those beautiful hip barns. You know, I'm not talking about my sore left hip, but the hip barns are just, they're just beautiful works of art, and so many of them are sitting empty, but
there's a lot of people out there who worked in those barns that are out there for an audience for your podcast.
Absolutely. They have the stories that to tell it. I can tell a story about baling hay, and you'll get 10 different versions of the best way to stack it, stack a load of hay, you know. We used to go five high. My neighbor, he wanted to get as much hay on that wagon as possible. So he'd go a little bit higher, but then if you hit a rut at the wrong time, you'd end up losing half your load. So it takes people back, and sometimes we try to keep our AWG rating for our podcast. I think as of right now, we're the only podcast that you can access with an AWG rating.
Dan, how the heck did you run into Daryl and come get going on this podcast?
Well, that's an interesting story. So I host a buy, sell, and trade show on Saturday mornings on WIZM in La Crosse. And the first hour is usually pretty slow. So I have to fill time. We don't play music, so I fill time. And sometimes I talk about farm life, farm mm-hmm. stories, you know, baling hay or shredding corn or thrashing, or threshing is what we did on the farm when I was young.
Yeah.
And then Daryl heard me talk about a story where one Easter, I wanted to surprise my mom with an Easter basket full of candy. However, I had to hide it somewhere so she wouldn't find it. So I put it in the hay barn. Not a good idea because the mice got into it. And then I also put a few presents for my Uncle Art and my dad, who farmed together. They were brothers. And so when they opened up the feed box, they had their Easter basket too. Well, Daryl heard that story, and I think he called me during the news break, was it?
I did, Dan. I tell you, Larry, Dan is such a smooth talking, and he has so many deep stories, such a deep well of information that I knew I had to hear more of those stories.
So he called me during the news break and said, Dan, is there any way you and I can get together and talk? I've got this great idea of a podcast. And I'm going, yeah, that sounds kind of interesting. You know, I never saw myself as a podcaster, never mm-hmm. thought of it. But we got together after a while. It took about a year to get together and actually make things work. But then we started working together. I retired from the La Crosse School District. Daryl just recently retired as well, and now we've got, what, 16 episodes?
16 episodes.
Yeah.
Number 17 is on tractors, if we can get it started.
Where's my sound effect here? Somewhere.
Yeah. Well, that's why, you know, when I enjoyed listening to you guys talk, you it's just a nice conversation back and forth, and it's at a pace that's different from the kind of pace that we're often accustomed to. It's a little bit slower, but it's more reflective, I guess. But then you do throw in some
I like to use sound drops quite a bit.
Sound drops yeah. quite a bit, which you know what they do? They recapture your attention too.
Mm-hmm. I like to add a little humor to each episode if I can, whether it's the sound drops or a joke or something like that, just to keep people on their toes.
Mabel in Duluth has been waiting a long time, and she has a story, I believe. Let's go there. Mabel, hi.
Hi.
Morning, Mabel.
Good morning. And I'm going to have to listen to that podcast. But I live in Duluth now, but we lived on a farm in North Dakota the first 12 years of my life. And I don't think we got electricity till about 1953, so everything was kerosene lamps. And I remember when they got an Aladdin lamp, we thought that was so wonderful because it was so much brighter. But we went to a one-room school, and my older brother worked on a ranch nearby. And when I was in the first grade in 1948-49, he paid our German neighbor to pick us up with his bus, which was pulled by horses and on sled runners, had a stove bolted to the middle of the floor.
Oh, my gosh. That's
and a couple
cool.
benches along the side. And I remember one time I was standing and leaning against a door, and the little wood block he had for holding it shut turned, and I fell out on the road.
Oh, no.
Well, there... Do you get response? That was a great story, Mabel. Thank you for calling in. But do you guys get response? I mean, now the podcast has been going for about a year.
We kicked it off about a year ago.
Yeah. Do you get feedback from folks like Mabel?
Yep. We do, Larry. It's interesting. We had a lady from Sparta. She told us about her grandma, her grandpa came home from the war, and he had been affected by mustard gas. So grandma had to not only run the house, but then she was also in charge of the chores and then the barn and the milking. And she said grandma could carry two bales of hay at the same time. So she was ready and willing to go, and she was switching from horses to tractors. And the local dealership brought out the new tractor. And he wanted to know if she needed to know how to drive it. And she said, no, I can take care of this on my own. And the guy left, and they asked, well, how do you know how to drive a tractor? She says, I don't, but I don't need a man to tell me what to do.
Mabel, thanks. And by the way, if you have a story to tell, or maybe just a question to ask about the podcast, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Visiting today with Daryl Wormadal and Dan Wiese, who are the co-hosts of the podcast. It's titled Farm Tales and Cow Pies. And if you type that into the search engine, you're going to find it pretty quickly.
Yeah, it comes up pretty fast, actually, on several different platforms.
Yep, just move the hay if you can't find it.
Okay. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about the podcast Farm Tales and Cow Pies with the two hosts of the podcast, Daryl Wormadal and Dan Wiese. It's great to have them with us. Again, if you want to join in with a comment or question, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Quick mention, at 11:45, we'll be talking about the soybean industry in Wisconsin. And then at 12:30, we'll learn how to make better coffee. But right now, it's Farm Tales and Cow Pies with our two guests. And Jeff in Pelican Lake, we'll go to you. Jeff, hi.
Well, I'm 77 years old, and just recently I realized that my family was a migrant family. And what we did is we traveled around the Midwest going from hatchery to hatchery sexing chickens.
Interesting.
And these are the chickens that came to the post office in those boxes with the little holes in them.
Yeah.
Well, so my dad would sex the chickens, and, you know, they always wanted the females. They didn't want the roosters, you know. And so the roosters went in a barrel, and the females went in a box. And I would always say, well, where are those guys going that go in the barrel? It was a paper barrel. They say, oh, they go out back. And they said, oh, can I go with you? He says, well, I guess. So they took me outside with a dolly and the paper barrel, and they put them in an incinerator.
Oh, my goodness. I couldn't believe, you know, why wouldn't you raise them?
Yeah.
And then if nothing else, you'd eat them.
We used to get that in the spring. We'd get that box of chickens, and you'd bring it in, and, you know, they were always so cute and fluffy, and it was, I guess, I don't know if we were sexing chickens, but we would raise them for meat. But Dan's family, they actually raised eggs, chickens, 200 chickens. So.
Yeah, we had about 200. It's interesting, back in those days, I think farmers liked to kind of hedge their bet a little bit. We were a big farm, milking 60 dairy cows.
Huge.
But we had a couple hundred chickens. We had pigs. We had geese. We had some ducks.
Did you have tobacco?
We did not, but everybody around us raised tobacco.
Okay.
Yeah. Everybody. Yeah. And I'm that's how I made a lot of money in the summer, was working for farmers in their tobacco fields. Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think that's one of our upcoming episodes is talking about tobacco. We had about an acre and a half of tobacco, and it's quite the process, quite the backbreaking process as well, but actually enjoyed it growing up.
I was thinking about, as you were talking about that, I was thinking about one of the podcasts I listened to when you were talking about potatoes, because you were talking about planting potatoes, and those potato planters were kind of like a tobacco planter, in many ways, because we had potato planter, and of course all the neighbors, they'd share a planter, you know, guys that would.
That was interesting back then, Larry. How neighbors would kind of work together. You'd have one guy that would have the potato planter, one guy that would have the threshing machine. We had one guy that would have like the hay baler or whatever, and you'd kind of shifted around so that you didn't all have to have all those big machine sheds full of expensive equipment.
Tyler in Westby, we'll go to you next. Hi, Tyler.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Great. Doing well. Thank you.
Well, I just wanted to comment that not all the small dairy farms are gone. My wife and I just bought her family's farm, and we milk 40 cows and farm 120 acres, and we're organic, so makes it a little easier to make it, but we're making it just fine.
Oh, awesome. Good to hear.
Thanks very much. There are quite a few organic farms now in Wisconsin, some parts of the state where we've got some places where they can co-ops that are. And Tyler, you probably have a co-op that you work with.
Yep, the Westby Creamery in Westby, Wisconsin.
Yeah. It's just down the road from us, about 45 minutes from Stoddard.
So there still are some small farms out there, but
absolutely. Well, and you get up into certain areas. You have like the Mennonites and the Amish farming. There's a lot of the smaller farms, and like the caller was mentioning, they're profitable. There's ways to do it, and that's what's so interesting about we're not bigger, we're not small, we're not left or right. We just love talking about it. I speak fluent ag, Larry. So
you're talk a little more about how you pick a tie. It's a half hour.
About a half hour, yeah. Daryl's the executive producer. I'm just gonna say that.
So you come up with how do you come up with your topics?
Well, some of it is just through, basically from growing up and remembering back. A lot of it, Larry, is from books that I've read. Jerry Apps, Michael Perry, Ben Logan, The Land Remembers, one of my favorite books. You read those books, and each chapter just takes me back, and I just draw on that. Like and then with Dan, he's so good at, we start talking about a subject like manure. And you know that's you feed the cows and you get the milk production, but you also get the other end of the situation. And boy, there's so many things involved with moving manure. And back in the 50s and 60s, we didn't all have barn cleaners and pits and irrigation hose and all that stuff. So yeah, we're gonna be spreading the word with manure in one of our future episodes.
Oh boy, that's gonna be interesting.
You guys do a lot of. You had one thing you got going about sayings. And there's some great old sayings that you learn on the farm. I was talking to Clara before the show, and I was trying to remember. I remembered a couple. If you start thinking you have some influence, try ordering somebody else's dog around.
That one we didn't include in our podcast.
Oh, Dan, there goes
part three.
Part three.
Yeah, there we go.
Oh yeah.
Oh, my grandpa said he was arguing, talking with a guy who didn't want to. he was being a little, the other guy was being a little stubborn, and my grandpa turns and says, "You know, a wink's as good as a nod to a blind horse."
Oh, gosh.
Well, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
There you go. I've burned through aisle. There's some more, but you guys will just sit and talk about those. And
yeah, we just we come up with ideas ahead of time. We both make our notes, and then we get together, and some are duplicates, some are not, and we just sit down, and just like we're sitting here, we sit and talk for about a half hour.
What might it be important for non-farmers to learn about agriculture and what it was like then?
Well, I guess the one thing that we've noticed is farming is definitely a family affair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for me, working with AgriView for the past 34 years, it really still is a family affair, whether you're running 160 acres of the old quarter section farm, or you're running 5,000 acres, it's a family unit. They still, whether you have employees or you're just doing it by yourself, the family involvement, the day-to-day running, how everybody pitches in. If there's, Dan and I were talking on the way down, how some places when the clock strikes 3 o'clock, some people are ready to leave at 2:30, but on the farm, if you had to get another load of hay in or it was going to rain, you kept that ball going forward. And if you didn't, then Dad probably would help you.
Yeah, it's the family togetherness, too. I mean, the family working together, like Daryl said, and just the relationships that you build with that. And it's something I remember. That's probably one of my biggest takeaways is how hard they worked, how we all got along, worked together for a good cause. And somehow, after chores and after all the baling hay, my folks still had time to play ball in one of our fields. You know, it's just like, how do they do that? You know, I get home from work, it's like, I'm tired. I'm not going to go out and play ball, but they somehow had the energy after baling hay all day, milking cows twice a day, and all the other things that go along with that.
And that's the thing about milking cows, which you can't stop. Say, well, I'd like to go away for the weekend.
No.
Yeah.
You don't punch out. That like Dan and I, we were talking about that, too, how our folks, you know, Dad, if he was feeling sick, you know, the cows were still smiling in the barn.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't, there was nobody to replace them. And the number of times, I don't know how they did it, or keeping things running. You know, that we have that four-letter word that rhymes with blow coming up here, and Dad would have to go out and move the snow to get the milk truck in, but then sometimes the power wouldn't work. So we had a little generator, but Dan was talking about how we could even hook up a tractor to get enough vacuum to milk the cows. So yeah.
It's hard work.
How to change oil, Larry, but I'm usually pretty good about letting somebody else even handle that.
Yeah, and one thing growing up on the farm, too, is my dad was pretty particular who could milk the cows.
Yeah.
He was the only one. I never had a chance to actually do the milking with the buckets, the surge buckets, other things, carrying the milk and so forth and washing the udders. But we never took a vacation. We never, you know, went away for a week or even overnight anywhere that I remember. It was just you're tied down twice a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, I had an event once that involved folks coming to my house, for Wisconsin Public Radio listeners coming to my house, and it was a little extra money and was for raising money for the station, and a farm wife called me and she said, I want to bring my husband to your event, and I said, well, that's great. She said, I haven't told him yet. I'm not going to tell him until after I send the check in. Hmm. And I said, she said, we live on a dairy farm and we haven't had a vacation in 30 years. This is our vacation.
Hmm. Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah.
Well, as it turned out, he came. I think he had more fun than anybody else there.
Awesome.
Another thing, Larry, I did a presentation at a senior a living community, and most of the gentlemen that came to it weren't from the farm. but mm-hmm. they were just interested in something, and they asked a lot of questions. And farming, you know, it's not just going out and starting a tractor and baling hay. You know, nowadays that's you're running a lot of expensive equipment, and they were just blown away at some of the stuff that was going on out there.
Yeah. Fran in Madison has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Fran.
Hi, I have a question about the front window on the farmhouse. We lived in a farmhouse that needed a window repair. It was taken out, but on the top of the window was a beautiful piece of glass. It was amethyst, deep purple. Some were green, but I'm wondering if your guests know anything about the fact that in the window, in a lot of farmhouses, there was a very colorful piece of glass put in. Do you know anything about that?
And at the top of the window.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't. We grew up in a three-bedroom ranch, but I know, Daryl, you live in a century-old house. Yeah.
I know that our windows are, we kind of can tell which way the wind is blowing because of which way the curtains are going. And I think Larry has had previous guests that work on home improvement that could explain why they would have that kind of window.
I think for one thing, this you know, the sun's higher, and so it was like a partial shade. And also, we had that in our farmhouse. And also, when the sun was hitting that, you got some really cool, interesting light inside the house.
Sure.
So it was... I think it might have been for kind of like a shade, and but also for attractive. It looked nice outside, and it really looked nice inside when the sun hit.
Well, then that makes good sense.
Fran, I think that's why we had it in our house, I believe, although I think it was there when we got there to that particular farmhouse. But thank you for calling. You can join in, too. Number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Well, milking never does end, as we were talking about. Do you have a story? What do you remember about milking? There's things I remember. There was one cow in particular that I did not like very well, and she didn't like me.
Well, we had a rooster that didn't like me, but as far as the cows, they all kind of loved me, and I love them. As far as a story... Oh, boy, I don't know if I have anything right off the top of my head. But I do remember the cows always knew their spot.
Yeah.
And if you let the cows out, you come back in, they knew exactly where to go. However, if you got a new heifer in, then that threw everything off, and it took a few days to get things back into sequence. But we had a cow named Trixie. I know Karen would be better, my sister Karen would be better at telling this story, but we were just talking about that at church yesterday. I don't remember the whole story, though, Larry. Can I call Karen right now?
That's all right.
Phone a friend.
The one thing that I remember about the cows, there was a lead cow.
Yeah, the boss cow. Mm.
There was the boss cow, and the boss cow always led the pack. And we had a dog, Teddy, and when they were out on the pasture, my dad would say, "Teddy, go get the cows." Hmm. And Teddy would run out there and get, I forget the name of the lead cow, but he'd get the lead cow going, and the rest of them would just follow her right to the barn.
Yeah, you'd think that, you'd look at the cow paths, and you'd think, well, they've all got the same distance, they could all just take off like a cross-country race, but
no,
the path is narrow, and the boss cow is in the lead.
Follow the leader.
Well, it's just one of those things. You know, this is one of the fun parts about listening to your podcast, because for me and for thousands of other people who grew up when I did, it starts bringing to mind a lot of things that happened back in your life and back in those times.
Yep, that's some of the feedback back that we get, Larry, is people say, I listened to your podcast, and then we were going for a drive, and I say, we'll see the tractor out in the field. Well, remember when we used to have that IH tractor with the cultivator, and how Dad got hooked up in the woven wire fence? Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
And we had, you were talking about food. One of your podcasts was about food, and you were talking about pancakes. reminded me that my mom, and I think she might have gotten it for Christmas one year, a Sunbeam waffle maker.
Oofta.
Yeah, that was, and it did two waffles at the same time.
That's a good way to go. We talked about the Sunbeam or the Lefse grill and how they would, those pancakes, and you just have those pancake eating contests. And I hate to admit it, Larry, but I think I came in second on too many of them.
Well, it's a lot of fun to think about those times. You talked, and, you know, this is National Sandwich Week, isn't it, Jeff? It's National Sandwich Day, Jeff, today. And that reminded me about your story. You were talking about sandwiches and funeral sandwiches.
Oh, yes. Yep.
The cheese whiz and the crushed potato chips.
Cheese whiz and crushed potato chips. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Those were so good. That was always my favorite at potlucks and funerals. I don't know why we don't make them at home now, but I didn't even think about it until Daryl brought it up in one of our recordings.
I had to chuckle when I heard that because I've had those too, or had those. I haven't had one of those in a long, long time. And gardening?
I'll have to defer to Dan because, like I was telling you earlier, Larry, my gardening's in set aside.
The set aside program for gardening.
Yeah, well, gardening growing up, we had strawberries, a lot of potatoes with a potato planter, and of course, we had the digger at the end of the season. I don't remember a whole lot of what we would raise as far as plants. I think radishes was probably one of them, but we still have our own garden on the same plot because I actually live on the farm that I grew up on, which is I'm very thankful for.
That's very cool.
So it's a lot of memories there, too, and how, you know, as we plant the seeds in the spring and harvest in the fall, it's like I can remember my mom and dad out in this field. And the same way with all the memories, you know, I was just thinking on the way down to this when I was, I don't know how old, my dad and I built these cement steps to our granary, and they're still there. And so I sit down there and kind of reminisce a little bit, too. All the machine sheds have, you know, memories in it, and I remember them putting a lean-to on one of the machine sheds, and I was there helping. Cold there as a kid. But the garden, yeah, now we do a lot of tomatoes and so forth. My wife likes to can tomato sauce and spaghetti sauce. Don't do many potatoes like we used to, even though we still have the potato planter sitting in the shed. So we'll have to work on that.
You should oil that up and get her going again.
You know, I'm thinking about that. We have a Ellis Chalmers bee in the shed yet that I want to get running next year. That's one of my goals. And you never know. We might have to get the potato planter out. And I don't know if we can bring the tobacco planter out because we still have that, but I don't think we have an allotment anymore.
All that food, it reminded me about the harvest time, too, and the threshing crews.
Yes.
Oh, the big meals that they used to set out, Larry. We didn't do threshing. Dan did, but we'd have we'd do silo filling time, and Mom would have to all the big meat and pies and all the stuff and like I said, a lot of my material I come from reading books, and they would talk about how they'd know which wives were the good cooks, and they'd slow it down. Maybe instead of one day, we could make it 2 days so we'd get two meals. And then the other next one, you'd maybe want to push it hard so that you could maybe get on to the next good meal for lunch.
So it was, it was a lot of fun for me, too. And I think there was a little competition because the farmers all kind of worked together and they'd go from farm to farm and do the work. And there was always a really big meal, no matter where you were.
Yeah, threshing was always one of my favorite things in the summer. I look forward to that and shredding corn because we did that as well, even though we had a corn picker. But those were such good times. Yeah, those are awesome times.
Well, now it's getting cold, and there was some good conversation about the heating situation in homes, which I enjoyed hearing a lot about because we had the same situation in our home where there was a register on the floor,
Oh.
And that's where the heat came from.
Hot air rises, they tell me. Although, I tell you, Larry, sometimes I'd get out of bed in January and I could write my name on the frost on the bedroom window. So,
well, now this podcast, it's usually about a half hour, mm-hmm. right?
About a half hour, yeah.
And you guys just have a nice conversation. There's a little inserts here mm-hmm. and there to move it along a bit. But how do people get the podcast?
Well, the main way, Larry, I recommend is Google. I know that's not an action or a verb, but if you start typing Farm Tales and Cow Pies, it'll take you to a website where we have all the past episodes, or they can get it on their favorite podcast. Where if you get it on Apple or Spotify or
Amazon
Music.
Yep, it's on there too. Yep.
It's all up there in the cloud somewhere, Larry.
Yeah. How's the listenership going for it?
Well, we've been growing organically, and now we're hoping to get some fertilizer on there too that'll beef it up. It's going well. I kind of am a stat man from working with advertising, and I enjoy looking at the dashboards and seeing that we've got listeners in just about every state. And we've had listeners abroad. Now, I don't know if it's Peggy from Russia or not, but it's just neat to see the reach that we never would have got if we were just sitting there sitting around the we're Chevrolets at the local mm-hmm. Eating place.
Yeah. Well, it is a lot of fun to listen to. It brings back a lot of memories for me, and I want to thank you guys for taking some time to be with us today.
Thank you.
A lot of fun
thank you,
reminiscing and talking about your podcast. I enjoyed it very much. Daryl, Dan, thank you
very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Larry.
We're going to go from the past a bit and what went on back in the day to what's going on right now in the soybean industry. So next we're going to be talking with a guy who knows a whole lot about soybeans and is very actively involved in it right now. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News, and our guests, Daryl Wormadal and Dan Wiese. Podcast is titled Farm Tales and Cow Pies, here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, soybeans are among the top crops grown by Wisconsin farmers, right up there with corn, and we're going to get an update now about the soybean industry. Larry Mueller here, by the way. My guest, Tony Melanthin. Tony is the United Soybean Board Director representing Wisconsin, and also farms in Ogallala, Wisconsin. So we'll talk with him about the soybean situation, and let us know your questions about soybean farming. Do you grow soybeans maybe on your farm? What was the crop like this year for you? If you're not in the ag business, what questions do you have about soybeans? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. Tony Melanthin, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm excited to be on. And again, just thank you for letting me come on to your show and talk about the wonderful world of soybeans.
Well, tell us first about your farm. You got Melanthin Farms. Talk about what you grow and how long this farm has been part of the family.
Right. Yeah, so on our farm, we grow corn and soybeans. I farm alongside my dad. He started farming in 1981, but my grandpa started this farm when he moved up from southern Wisconsin from his farm he grew up on. He moved up here in 1965. So we've been on this farmstead since 1965, started out as your traditional Wisconsin dairy farm. And in the late 90s, my parents made the decision to transition from dairy farming to row crop farming. And when we did that, we had grown soybeans, you know, while we still had cows, but then we increased the soybean acreage after that.
Yeah, and soybeans, I mean, we grow a lot of soybeans here in Wisconsin. I think it's like 100 million bushels or something like that. It's a lot.
Yeah. Yes, about 100 million bushels. I think it's a little north of that nowadays, but it's just north of 100 million. And it, you know, it all kind of depends on the year, how the yields are and crop rotation wise, but that's a good round number to say.
So, and what was the crop like this year? Pretty good, I've heard.
Yeah, for us, you know, I'm here in western Wisconsin. And so for us, the crop has been, I'd say above average, but pretty good actually. So, you know, we're really happy with the yields, and prices have come around recently.
What are they at, about $10 a bushel or thereabouts? Or
yeah, they've come around a little more now. So now they're about $10.50. So
that's so if you do the math on that, if you figured 100 million bushels, you're talking more than $1 billion there in sales, or $1 billion in terms of the economy of the state, well, maybe $1.5 billion.
Absolutely. I don't have that number exactly, you know, and that's just the soybean sales part. You know, obviously, when you have farms in the rural communities, that's supporting jobs, equipment dealerships, local co-ops, stuff like that. You know, farming is really, in my opinion, the lifeblood of rural America, and you know, whether that's dairy farming, crop farming, or any other type of farming.
Gregory in Niagara has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Gregory.
Yeah, hey, Larry. Thanks for having the guest on. The question is, you know, like, we depend on other countries to buy soybeans from us, and it always seems like Americans don't really consume soybeans. And I talked to a farmer, his name's Jeff, he works with me, and he said that if you consume too much soybeans, they can be poisonous for you. But I don't believe that. I just want to hear what the guest speaker would say about that.
Yeah. All right. Greg, thank you for calling. Well, I suppose if you ate too much of anything, it could be a problem. But go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, and I'm not the expert in the dietetics of it. I do know, you know, food grade soybeans are safe for human consumption. There is a great institute. It's called the Soy Nutrition Institute, and you can look them up, and you can go to their website. And not only do they have a lot of great recipes for utilizing soy in human diets, but it also talks about, you know, the health benefits of it. So I can't speak to that, you know, the in-depth details. I know there is a lot of soy consumption globally. So, you know, maybe it's partially how soy is processed. I know when you're talking about ruminant animals, so cows and stuff, soy typically needs to be roasted, and I'm not a nutritionist as far as the reasoning why.
Yeah. All right, Greg, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. David in New Richmond, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, David.
Hey, Larry, since you brought up the vast dollar amounts there that this crop could bring to the state, I'd be curious for your guest to tell us what his crop input costs are compared to what he's looking to make per bushel. And seeing how our administration recently sent a bunch of money to Argentina, who turned around and sold their majority of their soybean crop to China, How that is affecting the market.
Okay.
Yeah, so as far as a break even per bushel, you know, I know I sounded excited to be able to sell 1050 beans, but that's really just because a month ago they were $9. 1050 beans is, depending on where your yields come in, that's roughly your break even. Each operation's a little different. Some operations, the break even is probably $11 a bushel. Some operations, it may be 10, but input costs, and it doesn't matter which input you're talking about, if you're talking about seed, fertilizer, equipment, interest rates, all of it has really gone up significantly in the last couple of years, and that has brought our cost of production up as well. So $10.50 to $11 for a lot of farms, that's what a lot of farms need to keep the lights on, essentially.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily you're making a whole bunch of money here if your break-even point is the same as what you're selling it for.
Correct.
What? But and David mentioned the sort of international part of it, and I think, well, how much do we export of our crop? It's a good percentage of our crop goes elsewhere.
Yeah, it's a little over half of our crop.
And
so nationwide, it's a little over half of our soybean crop.
Yeah, and I think it's even a little higher for Wisconsin than half. But it.
Yes, it is.
But then we're selling to who? We got three main trade partners, I think, on it. I think.
Yes. Three main would be a good way to put it. China purchases a lot or has in the past, Mexico, European Union. And then there's a lot of Southeast Asia countries, and we're beginning to open markets in the Middle East and North Africa for U.S. soy as well. So I guess China accounts for roughly 60% of the global soybean trade. So that obviously is the big player in the market.
Yeah.
So.
I think we also trade a lot with Canada and Mexico as well. The tariffs probably have made maybe we can spend a little time talking about tariffs after we take a look at the news. But somebody else was asking about varieties. Do you grow a lot of varieties?
Yes, there are a lot of options out there. There's, you know, when it comes to purchasing seed, no matter what quote unquote brand you purchase from, your seed really comes from four, maybe five different seed company genetics. So each company then makes varieties that are tailored to growing regions and, you know, north versus south and east versus west and soil type and whatnot. So it can get pretty complex as far as choosing the right variety for your farm. But, you know, when we were talking about inputs, that is part of it. When, you know, four or five companies control pretty much the entire genetic pool of your soybean seed, you know, there's only so much you can do.
Tony Melanthan, our guest, we're talking soybeans with him today, and he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. I will get into tariffs and that kind of situation as well as we visit with him, and hope you'll join in as well. We're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News, and then we'll be back with Tony. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking about the soybean industry in Wisconsin right now with our guest, Tony Melanthin. He's the United Soybean Board Director representing the state of Wisconsin. He also farms in Ogallala. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What are your questions about maybe commodity markets and how farmers fit in them? Let us know your questions. Give a call at 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Tony, we just heard in the news President Trump was commenting on, in general, about tariffs. But what about the tariff situation as it relates to soybeans now?
Right. So I think tariffs in regards to soybeans, I feel like that's ever-changing, whether it's a news story or a tweet or a Truth Social post. It can, that any one of those things can move the market 20, 25 cents. One thing we have noticed, it just creates a little different ebbs and flows in the soybean world. One thing that I will note, it has given us an opportunity as the Brazilians have essentially torn down rainforest to sell China soybeans. Their quality has diminished significantly, and this has given us an opportunity to showcase the higher quality U.S. soybeans to buyers that maybe were just looking at price per bushel or price per ton versus the actual value and quality that you get. So if I kind of want to spin a positive out of this, that has given us that opportunity that otherwise was hard to achieve.
So the tariffs themselves, I think he made a deal with China to at least cut back the amount of tariff, right?
I believe you're right. I don't even know if I know all the final details of it. And part of that agreement, my understanding is, China promising minimum commitments of U.S. soy over the next 3 to 4 years.
But other than that, it's still kind of up in the air, you're saying?
Yeah, I don't know if up in the air is the right word. I think maybe with harvest, I haven't been kept in touch as much with it, but I believe, it's just an ever-changing dynamic, and until all the dust settles, I'm not sure exactly end of the day where it's going to settle at.
Mike in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Yes, I'm wondering about alternative uses in the United States for soybeans instead of exporting them. You talked about it towards the end of the last hour about how we didn't use that many soybeans in the United States but we produce so many of them primarily for export. So what are alternative uses? I know there are, also if you could talk about crop rotation, the land that we use for soybeans, is that alternately used to produce corn? And is that corn that's used for ethanol, or is it corn that's used for animal feed, and why, since we have a glut of soybeans here now, you can make oil out of soybeans. How about producing more biodiesel or some other alternate sources for it? And also talking about crop rotation, I know one of those things that's inserted into the crop rotation between corn and soybeans is sugar beets. And can we grow sugar beets in Wisconsin? Is there a market for those, and what are their uses?
Yeah, I think you started to answer the question for me when you talked about biodiesel and renewable diesel. That is a great, great use of the soybeans. To back it up a little bit, when a farmer grows a soybean, then we sell it to an elevator. Essentially, down the road, a lot of the soybeans get crushed. So they separate out the what we call soybean meal, which is the animal feed part of it, with soybean oil. Now, that soybean oil can be used for human consumption, whether that be in your vegetable oils, your, you know, dressings, you know, stuff like that. But that oil can also be used for renewable diesel, biodiesel. And then conversely, the soybean meal, by and large, the soybean meal is consumed by animal agriculture. A lot of swine and poultry diets are heavy in soybean meal. So those are the areas that will, quote unquote, move the pile the fastest. However, there's always really, I think, innovative new uses for soybeans that we are creating, and creating as part of the checkoff. Some of that is soy foam. It's a firefighting foam that's PFAS free, and so it's a very environmentally friendly foam that can fight fires. It has no environmental concern, to my knowledge. Can replace the PFAS foam that's currently being used, and I think that's a great usage. Will that move the pile? No, but you get a lot of small innovations like that, and you can, you know, we are also used as environmentally friendly replacements for adhesives and paints. And, you know, if you back up and you think of anything that's made out of petroleum, can essentially be replaced with soybeans.
Yeah. Well, it brings to mind the United Soybean Board. You mentioned checkoff, and some people may not be familiar with what that is, but what does the board do, and it's financed through farmer checkoffs, if I'm not mistaken?
Yes. So the United Soybean Board is, we call it the soybean checkoff. So essentially what that means is every time a United States soybean farmer sells soybeans, 0.5% goes to this checkoff. Now, of that 0.5%, half of it goes to the national checkoff, which is the United Soybean Board, and half of it goes to the state, whatever state those soybeans were grown in. And so it's essentially a self-voluntary assessment, and it provides a way for as soybean farmers for us to pool together money. And what we like to say a lot of times when we're in meetings is we want to invest in projects and investments that the individual farmer can't. You know, what is the checkoff doing that I can't on my own farm? So a lot of our investments are export market orientated, as far as opening up, developing and increasing current and future markets. And there's also a lot being spent on innovation, as far as finding those new uses, whether it be soy foam, there's concrete sealant, there's, you know, asphalt replacement. One thing I haven't touched on that I think would be a really high interest in this state is there's a special type of soybean that's a high oleic soybean. And if you grow that, you can add that into the ration of dairy cattle, and it has benefits as far as milk fat components and production. So this is a differentiated soybean variety that has a higher end use, so to speak, where the soybean farmer can get a premium if they grow it. And conversely, the dairy farmer who's using it sees the benefit on their end as well.
So that's something that is part of, isn't it? I mean, the board itself, you invest a lot in research as well as in expanding markets.
Yes, yes. There is a lot spent on soybean research as well. You know, as far as, you know, on the growing side, whether it be researching disease, insects, weed issues, and doing the research to find a way for farmers to overcome the issues we're facing in the field.
Yeah. And, you know, this is soybeans, you need to, that crop needs to move in a year because there's another crop coming right after it.
Correct. It's they're not perishable, but yet, you know, when you're in the business of raising a commodity, you're not in the business of holding on that commodity long term. You're in the business of raising it and selling it and moving it. So, yes, they store for over a year, but as a farmer's concerned, we need to move them because we need to make space for the next year's harvest.
And you, I think on your farm, you have your own even large-scale storage and dryers, do you not, for beans and corn?
We do, yes. We have grain bins and a grain dryer. Typically, you do not need to dry soybeans. You can typically harvest them straight out of the field at the ideal moisture. And then we do have bins as well. Roughly speaking, we have enough to store, you know, two-thirds, three-quarters of our crop.
So that's pretty good. And you can store it that way for more than a year. But ideally, you want it gone within a year.
Well, yeah, I mean, will it keep over a year? Yes, but if we keep it in the bin for over a year, then the next year's harvest, instead of storing three-quarters of it, we'll only be able to store half of it. You know, so really, we clean out our bins every year, and that's just how our business is set up.
John wants to know how if you use the futures market in your soybean operation, or do farmers in general use the futures market to sort of lock in a price?
Yeah, I would say there's a wide array of comfort level with using the futures market. We do on a limited basis. There's a lot of different contracts out there available for farmers for hedging and, you know, getting a price locked in. A lot of farmers do use a combination of the futures market, some call options or just some options, whether they're call or puts, and just straight cash sales.
Yeah, we got a friend who has about 1,000 acres of soybeans, and he uses the futures market fairly extensively, but not entirely. So it can be used in combination to kind of try and lock in some pricing before the actual the harvest and prices of reveal themselves, I guess you could say. And somebody else is wondering, Kent in Reedstown actually emailed us, how much input and what kind of input do soybeans need, and are they GMO crops?
Okay, so for soybeans, you can grow GMO and non-GMO soybeans. There is a market for both. It's hard to say without knowing the specific field, and I don't know the percentage in the state of Wisconsin. You know, the majority of it is a GMO crop, but Wisconsin has a very nice non-GMO market, both in the north and south. So disproportionately, Wisconsin grows more non-GMO soybeans than a lot of states.
What are the biggest challenges facing bean farmers right now? What's weighing heavily the most on their minds?
You know, I think overall soybean farmers, we've been able to, you know, we know how to grow a good crop if Mother Nature plays with us. And, you know, a lot of people are really talking about how our input prices are just stuck and, you know, they don't come down when the price of soybeans come down, but they go up when the price of soybeans go up. And whether that's fertilizer, equipment, seed, you name it, there's just a lot of talk about really getting, you know, farmers feeling like they're getting pushed in a corner from the input side.
Yeah, that seems to happen in a lot of areas of agriculture these days. Aside from soybeans, I'm guessing anyway. And the prices, you know, the prices get determined by who?
Well, the price is supposed to be determined by the laws of supply and demand.
Yeah.
You know, but you're talking about the inputs, correct?
Yeah.
You know, you probably need to ask them that. Because some days I don't really know. You know, we're very quickly told that the price of fertilizer goes up because the cost of oil went up and it transportation and cost all. But then when the price of oil goes down, you don't usually see fertilizer go down. And that you can pick any input and kind of come up with that scenario where there's usually a pretty quick explanation on why they need to charge more, but never an explanation on why they don't go down when the prices go down.
So what happens, Jill wants to know, what happens when there's not enough space to store the crops?
You know, we've never really had that issue in western Wisconsin here because of, you know, I'll say the river market and delivery markets. Sometimes we run out of quote-unquote bin space, but then a lot of times, whether it's an elevator or the farmer themselves, in this part of Wisconsin, we can deliver it to a terminal on the Mississippi River, and they load on barges and kind of get it away from this area. Now, when that happens, unless you have forward contracted some bushels, typically the price you receive is going to be quite a bit lower because there's a lot of bushels out there and there's no incentive to pay much for those bushels because those are quote unquote the overflow bushels.
Yeah. So and considerably less, if I'm not mistaken.
Most years, yes. Yep.
Yeah. So that's. Not a good thing. Well, it's supply and demand kind of, I guess. The board itself, the United Soybean Board, it is made up of farmers, is it not?
Yes. Yep, it is. There's 77 farmer leaders on there. We do have a staff and a CEO, but the board itself is made up of farmers. The organization is farmer-led, farmer-driven. We really do believe strongly in that.
That makes a lot of sense, I think, because you're the guys, you're the people, men and women, who are doing the work, and to have that voice, I think you would have a hard time with a checkoff if you didn't have the strong farmer representation that you have. I'm pretty sure of that. Kathy in Fredonia, we'll go to you. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
I'd like you to touch a little bit on the use of crop insurance and how that can affect our bottom line and what some of the banks require of that.
Okay. Crop insurance.
Sure. Yep. So crop insurance is a tool that's available to every farmer. So essentially what happens in the late winter, in the month of February, you average out what the price of soybeans are, the November contract, and that's what the quote-unquote guarantee price is that a farmer can purchase, and then they can insure a number of bushels per acre based on their production history. Now, you cannot insure 100%. A lot of farmers insure, you know, 75, 80%. You can go up to 85%. And then as far as that being part of the bottom line, I would say it helps put in, you know, a floor, so to speak,
it is difficult when commodity prices are low or at break, I'll say at break even, you are still only insuring 75 to 80%. So you still do have a 20% risk there. And as far as the banking institutions go, a lot of banks will require crop insurance to get operating notes to essentially get a loan to buy the inputs to put the upcoming crop in.
And what is, I mean, there must be some kind of pricing. How much does it cost to insure?
Yeah, that all varies greatly depending on the level of insurance that you purchase and the county that you're in. But there's, you know, you can get it anywhere from probably $10 to $40 an acre, depending on how aggressive you want to be.
Okay, and in your mind, is it a good thing?
I think it is. Yep, in my mind, it is. We utilize it on our farm, and we're believers in it.
Through all this, what gives you hope for the future of soybean farmers in Wisconsin?
Well, as far as hope for the future, I think, you know, I try to just boil it down and simplify it as the fact that, you know, sometimes it's easy to get caught up in the negativities. We'll talk about South America trying to outcompete us. Oh, is there going to be demand for our soybeans? All that. Well, when I think about it, I think about soybeans are really, they're a fuel source, but they're a protein. So as the world demands more protein in their diets, and it doesn't have to be soy protein, it could be animal protein, because soy is fed to a lot of the animals. As more protein is into these diets globally, I really just believe strongly in the future of soybean and in the future of U.S. soybeans.
Well, Tony, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Appreciate it very much, and good luck with your own crops as we go into this we're into the harvest season right now. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you very much.
Tony Melanthan is the United Soybean Board Director from Wisconsin. He represents the state, also farms in Ogalle. It's great to have him with us. And we're going to turn our attention from one bean to another bean, the coffee bean. And we'll talk about how you can make a really good cup of coffee coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller. You know what? There's nothing like waking up to a warm cup of coffee, and you might be needing that extra burst of energy after daylight savings time. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for staying with us on WPR News. We're talking about how to make better coffee right at home, and we have a guest who knows all about that. Ryan Costales is with us. Ryan's the founder and CEO of Discourse Coffee in Milwaukee. He's the author of The New Art of Coffee, From Morning Cup to Caffeine Cocktail. Says, as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in with your own questions. Tell us how you make your coffee. What's your favorite creamer? Do you make your own syrup? Do you prefer it hot or cold? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Ryan, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in.
Larry, such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, listen, your website, you know, Discourse Coffee, I really like it. What your website says, you're a coffee workshop. What does that mean?
Yes, sir.
What does that mean?
You know, It's a long story. So we started 8 years ago up in Door County, Wisconsin, in Sister Bay, a beautiful little idyllic town up there. And something that we were always really serious about when we started was this ability to be constantly creating and innovating and changing. And at the time, and still very much now, you know, the coffee industry was very much ruled by kind of rote routine. This is what we do every day. We serve the same people every day. And we wanted something that was dynamic and new and fun and kind of a constant work in progress. And so instead of calling it a coffee shop, we decided at that time to call it a liquid workshop, something that was constantly in motion, something that was constantly changing. And upon moving to the city of Milwaukee in 2021, we thought it was necessary to disclaim to people that indeed we do serve coffee as our primary beverage. And so we changed to coffee workshop, but still keeping that workshop mentality of this is a dynamic experience. It's an evolving experience. And it's something that is a little bit different every time we come to enjoy it.
So what do you love about coffee and making new drinks?
Oh, man, what do I not love about coffee? I think what I love most about coffee is its diversity and its ingenuity and its constant evolution. You know, coffee is an agricultural product stemming back thousands of years. It is the most aromatically complex thing on planet Earth, far more complex than wine, and is the most widely consumed drug on the planet. About 1 billion cups of coffee a day are consumed. And yet it is still something that is so young in terms of its understanding. And what I mean by that is, Larry, if I were to say, I would like some juice, you would probably ask me some qualifying questions, right? Like, oh, do you prefer orange juice or apple juice? Do you want pulp or no pulp? Right? And these are things that we've acclimated to in our society. But if you were to say, if I were to say, hey, Larry, I'd like some coffee, you'd probably just pour me a cup of coffee. You wouldn't ask, oh, do you prefer Ethiopia, Panama, Colombia, Guatemala? Do you like a natural or a washed? Do you like a funkier cup? Do you want it immersion or pour over, right? But coffee is so diverse. It has all of this range. And so I love within coffee that we have infinite history, you know, history stretching back thousands of years, and yet our understanding of its potential is still so young. And so we get to play simultaneously in this space of legacy and inspiration and novelty. And that to me is just an endless joy. It truly is something that is kind of timeless and at the same time ever evolving.
Well, let's talk about brewing better coffee at home. Coffee starts, of course, with beans. What are some things to think about when you go to the store to buy beans?
Yeah, so a couple of big things, right? The first is, if you live in the proximity of a roastery, a local roaster, go directly to source. Right? Go to the roastery, go to a coffee shop that you trust that sells retail coffee, and talk to the baristas, talk to the team, talk to the roaster, the manager, and let them know what you like in coffee, right? And they are probably going to be able to point you to one of their products that best suits your needs and desires. They surely have a lot more information for you than the local grocery store, and almost definitely are going to be able to provide coffee for you that's been roasted more recently, is fresher and a more vibrant expression of the product. So my number one recommendation is always go, if you have one, go to a local roastery or a local coffee shop. And we're so lucky in 2025 that I'd say the overwhelming majority of American communities have at least one coffee shop that is conscientious about the sourcing and the maintenance of their coffee. If that is not an option for you and you are going to the grocery store, my biggest recommendation, you know, is to understand the notes that you are looking for in coffee and do a little bit of research ahead of time to discover, okay, what coffee is going to best suit these desires. So if I want a really chocolatey, rich, you know, bittersweet, 90% dark chocolate, a little bit of caramel, but like really rich and bitter and intense and kind of has that burnt characteristic to it that sometimes is really enjoyable in coffee, I might be looking for a Northern Italian roast, right, where they're going to roast it really dark. I want a really dark roast because what I want to taste is the charred oils on the outside of those beans. If I decide that I want something a little more caramely, a little more nutty, but I might go to something from South or Central America, something like Brazil or El Salvador. And if I want something that's fruitier, I might look at a Colombian coffee or an Ethiopian coffee or a Panamanian coffee, coffees that grow in warmer climates where that sugar concentrates and you get this beautiful kind of fruitiness or tropicality or berry character that can come out of the coffee. So recommendation number one, try to hit a local roastery. Recommendation number two, if you can't, inform yourself a little bit about what you're looking for before you go into the grocery store. So when you're there, you can look for exactly the coffee that fits your desires.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm wondering, you know, I've interviewed folks recently about chocolate and ethically sourced cacao. What does it mean for coffee to be ethically sourced?
It's a terrific question and a super, super important one. You know, so over the last 10, really 20 years now, in the advent of what we call third wave coffee, or the movement of coffee that came after the second wave shops like Starbucks and Caribou, that's really focused on quality and really focused on transparency, the equity model for coffee has completely transformed. And, you know, something I think that's really important to remember, Larry, about both coffee and chocolate, is that coffee is an agricultural product, right? So when we see it, we see this roasted little bean, but it starts off as the seed of a cherry on a farm in a distant land, right? And so in creating a system of equity within coffee, the real answer, the real question, right, is how do we get the most amount of capital and equity into the farmers' hands, the people who are empowering the entirety of the process. And, you know, for a while, fair trade was kind of the thing, and then organic kind of swooped in, and organic coffee is really not as equitable as many people may think it is, because organic certification is very expensive, and many farmers around the world simply cannot afford the pay to play to create organic certification, even if their processes are at or above the level of certification for an organic farm. So the true nature of an equitable relationship in coffee today is what we call the direct trade partnership. And what that means is that the farmer and the buyer, the roaster, have a direct relationship. The roaster has been out to the farm, they've tasted the lots, they've met the farmer. And oftentimes now, a roastery will actually buy an entire lot. So they'll come to a farm, they'll taste many different lots on what's called a cupping table, or essentially a tasting table for coffees. And when they identify the ones that they like, they will purchase the entire lot of that coffee. And this has really been a sea change from 20 years ago, where many, 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 many small shareholder farms would all send their coffees to central mills, where the coffees would be blended and processed and then sold as a coffee that represented that mill, right? And that mill then set the prices for all of the farmers. Now, American, Japanese, Korean buyers are working directly with farmers, advocating for the most equitable price for the farmer. And so the most equitable way that you can invest in coffee today is through direct trade relationships, which are held by many of today's most kind of modern and successful roasteries.
So how how do you know then that you're buying some coffee that has been ethically sourced, the beans?
You know, I think the absolute best way, alluding to my first point, is head into a roastery, you know, and look at that roastery's website. If a roastery is doing direct trade, they will be loud about it. You know, they'll be earnest and honest about their transparency. And we actually, in the industry now, we call this a transparency report. And many roasteries that are really pursuing coffee at high levels provide immense amounts of information in their transparency reports about who they bought the coffee from, the lot, the farmer, the processor, the mill. Every step of the journey is clarified for the consumer. Sage does an amazing job of this out in Brooklyn, and they sell nationally. Onyx does an amazing job of this in Arkansas, and they sell nationally. So these are some really, really cool brands that you can trust are doing equitable work. But stopping into your local roastery and just saying, hey, do you have any coffees that were sourced on direct trade or fair trade arrangements? Is going to be your number one best best bet. If that is not available to you, oftentimes at the grocery store, they will label fair trade. And if you flip the bag around and read the little story on the back, you can oftentimes get a sense of, does this roastery have a direct relationship with this farmer? You know, sometimes the bag will say something like, we've worked with this farmer for 3 seasons now. You know, and in those cases, you know that these are roasteries that prioritize building long-standing equitable relationship between the producers of the agricultural and the roasters of the consumer good.
Ryan Castales, our guest today, founder and CEO of Discourse Coffee, talking with him about coffee and, you know, making a good cup of it. And we'll get into some more detail on that as we move along today. He's the author of the book, The New Art of Coffee, From Morning Cup to Caffeine Cocktail. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Well, I have a cup of coffee pretty much every morning, or maybe I'll have a couple of cups of coffee. What about you? It's fun talking about a good cup of coffee with our guest today, Ryan Castales. Ryan is the founder and CEO of Discourse Coffee and author of The New Art of Coffee, From Morning Cup to Caffeine Cocktail. You can call in with your own questions. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Just a look ahead. Tomorrow on the show, a couple of things that I think you're going to find interesting. We're going to be talking about the treatments for movement disorders. That's one of our topics. We'll be talking with the doctors about that. And we're going to also cover all you need to know about choosing an assisted living center for yourself or for a loved one. And I've had to go through that process myself, and so I'll have some comments of my own as we talk about assisted living center work on the show tomorrow. But right now, Ryan Castales, our guest. And you can join in again. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Ryan, should you grind your own beans, or can you buy pre-ground coffee?
You should absolutely grind your own beans. If there's one thing that you can do to increase the quality of your coffee at home, once you've bought the right beans for you, is to grind fresh at the time of brewing. So coffee is super, super, super subject to oxidation, which means that oxygen is hitting a thing and it's denaturing the beauty of it. But you're losing a lot of the volatile aromatics that make coffee so wonderful. And as soon as you grind it, you greatly increase that volatilization of all of those beautiful aromatics that we want to capture in the cup. So having a home grinder is absolutely a great way to increase the quality of your coffee. If you must buy pre-ground, toss it in the freezer. That's going to slow down that oxidation just a little bit.
And the grinders themselves, are there good ones and bad ones? Or
yes.
Oh, there are.
And we could have a whole conversation, like a literally probably 6-hour radio show just about the differences between grinders. But, you know, at a home consumer level, you know, you're going to get a better quality Boset, which is the two moving discs that create the ground coffee, with a manual grinder for a lower price than you will for an electric grinder. So if you don't mind doing a little manual labor in the morning to wake up, it is, you will almost always get a higher quality grind out of a hand grinder at the same price as an electric grinder. In the electric grinder world, there's so many different price points that you could buy into, from $100 up to $5,000. And, you know, I think at the $100 to $200 price range, looking at a grinder from either Fellow, they have a wonderful grinder called the Ode that does an excellent job for around $169, $200. Or looking at some of the early Baratza models, like the Baratza Preciso, are a great entry-level model that you can get into for a pretty affordable price that will radically transform the quality of your coffee at home.
Nate in Middleton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Nate.
Hey, good afternoon. Ryan, tell me, for a person who's making a single cup of coffee per day, AeroPress, pour over, what's the best option, full flavor?
Man, that's a great question. On a single cup, I think you probably nailed it on that AeroPress, but it's really going to depend on what you're looking for in terms of body. So if you are cool with a little bit lighter body, a little bit more clarity in the cup, if you prefer coffees from like Africa, Panama, Colombia, high altitude, you might be better served with a pour over like the Wave or the Switch from Hario. I love the Switch because you can either choose, do you want immersion, do you want a little more body today, or do you want that clarity of a more high bypass brew method? The Switch from Hario would be awesome for you. But if you want a big, chewy body, I think the AeroPress is definitely the way to go. If you want that clarity, I would look into something like the Switch or the Wave.
Oh, Nate, there you go. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Rick in McFarland. Rick, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, Larry. Say, I wanted to say that when guests visit our house, they always seem to remember that we offer heavy cream when we serve our coffee. And when we go out and buy coffee elsewhere, it rarely comes with cream. It's usually with a half and half. And I just want to know what your guest thinks of that.
Right.
I love the fact that you use heavy cream at home. You know, the economics of half and half make a lot more sense for most cafes. And also many cafes stock half and half to be able to produce breves, you know, which is a latte made with half and half instead of whole milk or alternative milk. So half and half, I think, will continue to kind of be that cafe staple. But most cafes are going to have some heavy whipping cream lying around. So if you have a strong preference for heavy whip, feel free to ask your barista. There's a pretty good chance that they might have it while out.
Ah, Rick, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. We got an email back to the question of grinders. Which are the easiest to clean, and how often should you be cleaning your machine?
That's a great question. You know, I've always found hand grinders to be the easiest to clean. Something like a Porlax JP40 is a great little low budget, easy to travel with hand grinder that can be very, very easily cleaned because it's very easy to disassemble it. You know, full cleaning regimens on a grinder can be kind of intimidating. You're opening up a mechanical thing. You're separating two birds. You have to make sure that you maintain alignment to show quality. And so it can be a little intimidating. But an easy weekly clean is purchasing some grinds. It's a product from Urnex, U-R-N-E-X. And the product is just called Grinds with a Z. And work about 30 to 40 grams of grinds through your grinder once a week, and you should be in a really good spot with maintaining that clarity and the cleanliness of the inside of your machine.
Nina in Menasha has a question. Let's go there. Hi.
Good afternoon. Oh, my gosh. You are so knowledgeable, and, oh, it's the passion. It's wonderful to hear. Thank you. I'm going to look up your website when I'm done off this call. My question is, I was raised roasting beans and stuff. My grandparents, they're passed. Their business is gone. But I personally order green beans from a Wisconsin company, and I roast them at home myself. But I never know about the processing method. Like, there's natural, washed, semi-washed, and I really get confused. What would you recommend? I mean, is there a better... I try to do organic, but you never know. You just got to trust them.
Washed.
100%.
Yeah, washed or semi-washed beans or what have you. What about it, Ryan?
Yeah, so first off, Nina, thank you so much. And it's so wonderful to hear when people are roasting at home. I love a little home roaster. There isn't one that is unanimously better. Myself, I have a preference for naturals. But I want to give you a really quick walkthrough that's just going to hopefully demystify what the heck they mean when they're talking about these things. So a washed coffee is a coffee where the producer is going to wash off the mucilage or the cherry that surrounds the seed of the coffee. And that seed is actually coffee. That's what we enjoy. And so in a washed coffee, all of that mucilage is washed off in a turbid water bath. And what that does is it creates a much lighter, cleaner cup of coffee. It's going to be a little less juicy or jammy, but it's going to really highlight floral, citrusy flavors. A natural coffee, they call it such as it was the original processing method for coffee, is where they just remove the outer layer of the cherry, and they keep all of that mucilage, all of that fruit, to dry into the coffee on the drying bed. And what that does is it creates a much richer, more dynamic, more fruity, more jammy cup of coffee. And I love those coffees, but a lot of coffee purists really prefer washed coffees. Now, in the middle of those two worlds, in what you're referring to as semi-washed, is what we call honeyed coffees. And honey coffees are a hybrid. They remove a varying degree of mucilage from the coffee. And you'll see terms like red honey, black honey, white honey. And these refer to the amount of mucilage that's left on the bean. So honeys are your hybrid coffees. They're right in between the clarity of a washed cup and the dynamic, juicy vibrancy of a natural cup. So there really isn't a better and a worse. I have excellent coffee professionals in our ranks who prefer washed, and I have excellent professionals who prefer naturals. It really is a matter of preference, but know that washed is going to give you a cleaner, more delicate cup, and natural is going to give you a more jammy, more robust cup.
There's Nina, thank you so much for calling. I've been really beautiful espresso machines all over the internet, anywhere from hundreds to thousands of dollars. What's an entry-level way to make espresso at home?
It was actually hinted at by the first caller here. Probably the most affordable way to make an espresso-ish coffee at home is going to be an Aeropresso. And I actually have a recipe for Aeropresso in my book. Aeropresso is essentially a concentrated coffee using an Aeropress. And espresso, there's a common misunderstanding that espresso is a type of coffee. It is not. Espresso is a brew method, and it is created by the inclusion of pressure in the brewing environment. So what's beautiful about an Aeropress is that you are the pressure. You push down on that plunger and you create a pressurized environment that enables you to grind quite fine and create crema, which is the emulsified oils of coffee that really only reveal themselves when put under pressure at a fine grind. So an Aeropress, which can be purchased for about $40, $50 online, and then using the Aeropresso method is going to be the cheapest way to get into a home espresso. Beyond that, you could get a lever machine, and they sell cheap levers now through companies like Flair for $300 to $500. Or you can upgrade to one of the beautiful Breville units like the Oracle that runs around
$1,200. Oh, lots of money there. I'm telling you, I looked at your website, Discourse Coffee, and I thought, I've got to get over and try out some of your drinks.
We would love that, Larry.
Give me one that you like a lot, and what's in it.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. We got about a minute.
Perfect. They're all kind of my babies, so it's like picking a favorite kid. But I'd say the most universally popular right now is our Channel Orange. And our Channel Orange is a take on a vanilla latte. So we start with a base of espresso, and then we take vanilla syrup. We oak age it on oak chips using an ultrasonic bath, and then we infuse it with a little bit of oak smoke. From there, we make a syrup from orange peels called oleosaccharum, and blend the two. To create a little bit of bitterness, because our espresso is sweet and not bitter, we use blackstrap bitters from Bittercube, which bring a flavor of molasses. And then on top of the milk, after we pour the latte, we add a little bit of candied orange powder from the peels of that orange oleosaccharum and some black lava salt. And almost all of our coffees are salted. Salt and coffee just creates really beautiful, dynamic, accentuated flavors and balances out any bitterness.
Oh, boy. Ryan, this has been a pleasure. We're out of time. Thank you so much. Will you be with us again? Come back and be with us sometime?
Anytime. I would absolutely love that. Thank you so much for having me.
Ryan Castellas, the founder and CEO of Discourse Coffee. You can find that online. He's also the author of The New Art of Coffee, From Morning Cup to Caffeine Cocktail. Lots of fun talking with him today. We'll get him back because I had a lot of questions I didn't get answered yet. Big thanks to you for listening. A big thanks to our team, including Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and again, thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.